The Fan on Demand.
Grass, clay, or hard court, wherever the game is played, we'll be there. This is your tennis show, Aces, with Roger Lajoie and Tom Tebbett of Tennis Canada. Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
And it is indeed Aces on Sportsnet 590, The Fan. Good evening, everybody. I'm Roger Lajoie. Tom Tebbett is with me. Another season of Aces, and thanks to all of you for bringing us back, because we're delighted to be here for 12 editions, Canada's only tennis-exclusive radio program, and we are delighted to be with you. Our opening segment of Aces is brought to you by Tennis Canada. Check out Rogers Cup in Toronto, August 4th to 12th. For tickets, visit rogerscup.com. And hey, you want some tickets? Tom Tebbett's got some, and we're going to give them to you a little later on the program. Mr. Tebbett, how you doing?
Great, Roger. Terrific to be back.
Great to see you again. Nice to be back for another season. We got a busy show. We want everyone to know, first of all, Tom has graciously consented to answer your questions in the last portion of the program. So if you got a tennis question for Tom, anything, please, folks, make them tough, make them complicated, try to get him thinking. He knows everything about tennis. You can tweet at the Rog 590, at the Rog 590. We can take him by Twitter or email the show, Roger at sportsnet590.ca. That's Roger at sportsnet590.ca. We're here for 12 weeks throughout the course of the tennis season, and we've got some tickets to the Rogers Cup that Tom's going to give out. We got a new fun way to do it later in the program, so stick around with us the whole hour, and we got a couple of big-time guests. Tell us about those guests there, Tom. Who we got coming up on the program?
Well, we got Stefan Trudel, who does the stats for all the Masters 1000 tournaments. He's a Canadian guy, grew up in Montreal, studied radio and television arts at Ryerson.
Excellent school.
And worked a little bit for Tennis Canada tournaments, made a good contact, got into doing stats.
Excellent
school. The last 12 years... Raj, you're an alumni?
That's correct.
Okay.
Continue.
Anyway, and he lives in Paris now with his wife and kids. And as I said, he's been doing this for 12 years, so he's like the stats guy par excellence on the tour. So he's very interesting and sort of an inside way of looking at the game that way. And our second guest in the middle segment is Ivan Ljubicic, really one of the finest men I've ever met in tennis. Just retired a couple weeks ago at Monte Carlo. Used to be number three in the world. Used to be president of the Players' Council. Just a very impressive individual. I think we're very lucky to have him on our first show.
Sensational. Nice to have him here for sure. All right, tell us about Stefan and lead us into the interview there. Let's hear from him.
Well, as I said, Stefan, you watch him on Sportsnet, all the Masters 1000 tournaments. He's the guy coming up with the numbers. He actually works for France Télévisions during Roland Garros. You hear him on there. So he's a very well-respected guy. And the first question I asked him is, what talent does it take to be a good statsman?
Well, funnily enough, I didn't start off in this business doing stats at all. Like you said, I was studying at Ryerson, and Tennis Canada called the Radio and Television Arts Department, where I was studying, and they asked to get five cameramen. And so my name was given, and then I started working for Tennis Canada in the summertime for 5 years. And then every year there would be an American company that would come by and provide tournament services. So they would do either the radar or the scoreboards and all the technological things that you need at a tennis tournament. And then one year in 2000, they said, listen, we're opening up a TV department. Would you like to travel the world and watch a lot of tennis? So I said, yeah, sure, why not? And that's how I got on board at the end of 2000. An American company called IDS gave me the nod to start working with them in television. And then they taught me how to properly do the statistics for tennis matches and as well as to do television graphics.
You're involved a little bit with Hawkeye. I know that Hawkeye does a lot of the graphic stuff at the Masters 1000 tournaments. How has Hawkeye changed over the year, and has it evolved a lot, and would it be more accurate now?
I think it's always been accurate. Obviously, there was a lot of testing done before it became, officially part of the ATP Tour and the WTA Tour as well. For me, the things that have changed is maybe the operators make less errors when they're outputting the points. For example, I don't know if you remember a few years ago in Indian Wells, there was a bad call between Ivan Ljubicic and Andy Murray. And what happened then is that the operator took the second bounce of the ball. And obviously the second bounce was, the ball was called in. but it wasn't. So I think the biggest change that Hawkeye has done in the past few years is to eliminate operator error.
And would you think that sometimes it's used just for television? I guess almost it's always just used for television. Do you think that they should be using Hawkeye at the clay court tournaments like, you know, Rome, Madrid, and eventually the French Open this year?
That's a very good question, Tom, and there's been a lot of debate on that, actually. Personally, I would like for Hawkeye to be used in an official capacity at these clay court events. Unfortunately, I think it's more of the old school tradition where, you know, the player looks at the mark and the umpire comes down and looks at that. I think that's really steeped into the minds of the players and the umpires, that, you know, the mark that you see is the mark that, you know, that I want you to call in or out, right? But for me, I think personally, Hawkeye is just as efficient on a clay court than on a hard court or a grass court.
But I suppose, obviously, on clay, the thing that can happen is they can look at the wrong mark. At least Hawkeye, you would think, always gets the proper mark.
Well, absolutely. I mean, you know, if it's 5-all in the set, you know, and they've played already, you know, 75 points, and there's been, you know, tons of rallies, there's going to be lots of marks everywhere on the court. And so, obviously, for the umpire to come down and to look, obviously, at his steps, so he makes sure he doesn't fall when he gets off the chair, and then to find a mark, for me, I find that, you know, very, very hard to do. And there's been cases in the past. I remember a match in Hamburg, back when Hamburg used to have a Masters 1000. It was a match between Leighton Hewitt and I can't remember his opponent, but it was the same situation, 5-all in the third set this time. He called the chair umpire Carlos Bernardes down to look at a mark, and obviously with our camera angles, we had, you know, the right mark or close to it, and then Hewitt was pointing to the other mark. He was saying, no, this is this mark, and then Carlos was saying the opposite and all that, and officially the umpire was able to overrule. I mean, his decision is the last one, right? So I think, obviously, yeah, if we do have Hawkeye on clay, you'd get rid of situations like that where, you know, you're not too sure where the if it's the correct mark or not.
There's a lot of stats in other sports besides tennis, and there's a lot of people who are analyzing the, you know, all the way you can use statistical research for matches and for players and stuff like that. This is a bit of a crazy question, but say Roger Federer offered you, I don't know, $300,000 a year and just wanted you to do stats on himself and also all his potential opponents and the players he's going to be playing. Do you think that your knowledge and all the experience that you have that you could significantly contribute to improving his tennis or his results?
That's a fairly good question. If you look at the movie Moneyball that came out a few months ago about the statistics in baseball, saying, you know, they would hire a team of players that that were older or had certain good stats in certain departments, and then that team ended up getting pretty far to the World Series and not winning it at all. So in some situations, the stats can be quite relevant. In another example, when I first started in this business in 2001, I remember, obviously, I'm sure you remember the Russian player Murat Safin. He had come to us, and he had said, look, I don't understand. I'm not winning that many points on my first serve, but I'm serving it. His first serve used to be at around 215, 220. And then we showed him with his serve placement, saying, look, you know, it's not exactly the speed that you get your first serve in, but it's where you're putting it in, right? And so Safin then took about 10 to 15 kilometers off of his first serve, but he was placing it a bit better. Hence, and then he ended up winning more points on his first serve. So he cut back his speed on his serve, but he just ended up placing it a bit better, and he was winning more points. So I think you have to, you know, depending on what statistics it is and what kind of player it is, I mean, it could be a feasible thing to do, but I don't think Roger Federer would necessarily need my help to get any better than he is now. So,
don't be so modest, Stefan. I watched a lot of hockey lately with the Stanley Cup playoffs obviously being on, and, and one stat I'd like to see taken, and they never reveal it, but is how much time the puck is in the opponent's end and how much time the puck is in your end. In other words, from the blue line in at either end of the ice, because if you've got the puck there in your opponent's end, you're in no trouble and you have more chance, I think, to win the game if you can have it there.
Sure.
But we never see that stat. So I was just wondering if there's a stat like that in tennis that you'd like to see used a little bit more?
Well, one stat that we do have and we do keep track of, but it's not shown at the end of the set summaries, is the forced errors. Because obviously, you know, you have an unforced error where the opponent should have made that shot. And that you see a lot of those. You see the winners and unforced errors. But a very indicative stat is the forced errors. So sometimes, for example, if you have somebody like Radek Stepanek or Michael Laudre, these players that that do the serve and volley, their opponents, if you look at, they will not have that many unforced errors. Because since those players are continuously rushing to the net and coming forward, they're forcing their opponents to try to pass them or to try to make a different shot. So I think forced errors could be a very telling statistics if we were, you know, able to get it out there a bit more.
Yeah, I mean, it's almost just a variation of winners, isn't it? So I don't understand why you wouldn't put it out there a little bit more.
Well, you know, I've told some of the people and all that, and they said, "Oh, we'll take a look at it." But so far, it's a statistic that we have for ourselves in the back room, if you'd want. But I'm trying to get out to the main tennis public.
Any difficulty for you in determining what's a winner and what's an unforced error, and what are the trickiest decisions you have to make in doing your job as a statistician?
Well, a winner is pretty clean cut. I mean, that's when the opponent doesn't touch the ball once you've hit it. Where it obviously becomes more tricky is telling the difference between the unforced and forced error. And now for us to determine that it's an unforced error, we have two criteria. The first one, and the most important one, is the positioning of the player's feet. So obviously, if he's, you know, his 2 feet are solid on the ground, and he's facing forward, and he hits his shot, normally that's a shot that he should be able to make, right? Obviously, when the players are on the run or outstretched, it's a more difficult shot to hit. And then, you know, you say, okay, well, if he doesn't make that shot, well, it's kind of normal that he didn't make that shot. So that would be considered a forced error. So it's obviously the positioning of the feet is very important. And then the second criteria is the speed of the ball that's coming and the spin and the effect that's put on it. Because, you know, when you have a guy like Nadal, who hits an incredible amount of topspin, I mean, those balls are hard to hit back. I mean, ask Roger Federer when he gets that topspin on his backhand, if he finds it hard to hit back, right?
Right.
So those are the two main criteria for to tell the difference between a forced and an unforced error.
And what talent do you think you need to be a good stats man?
You have to be alert, because you have to think that we cover 6 matches a day, you know, for the first few rounds. So that means that you get into work at 10 o'clock in the morning, the matches start at 11, and then you can be there till midnight, 1 o'clock sometimes. So you have to be alert. If you're doing 6 matches a day, say all the matches go to 3 sets, an average of 150 points per match. So you're looking at close to 1,000 points that you have to watch and analyze each day. So that's the main thing is concentration, and then obviously a knowledge of tennis. And if you have a background playing, you know, recreationally, that helps a lot as well to understand the game. But definitely you have to be awake and alert to watch so much tennis throughout the week. And this is my 12th year on tour, and I was guesstimating that I've done or worked on over 5,000 tennis matches in the past 12 years.
Does that mean you drank a lot of coffee while you were doing that?
I've drank my fair share of espresso, that's for sure.
What question do you get asked the most often about your job by people maybe in tennis or people you meet who don't even know that you're working in tennis?
I think the question I get asked the most often is, can I hop in your suitcase and go to the next tournament with you? it's, you know, I'm very grateful to do the job that I do. It's a pleasure for me to work in this fine sport and to be able to travel around the globe doing a job that I love. So I think the question that the people ask me the most is, are you tired of traveling? How are things on your family life? And, you know, where do I sign up to do this job?
Thank you very much for being a guest on Aces tonight. Really appreciate it. And we hope that, I guess, you'll be here for the tournament in Toronto in August.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I wouldn't miss that for sure.
Okay, great. Thanks again.
Great. Well, thanks a lot, Tom. And I'll see you somewhere down the road.
Interesting job for sure, man. You talk about a dream gig for a guy.
Places, you know, he gets to go all over the world, and he's actually a very nice fellow. I've only known him for a couple of years, but you know, he comes from Quebec originally. He lived and worked here for a while, and he's very, very good at his job. He's very like a dedicated student of doing the stats job at tennis tournament.
Interesting guy for sure. You talk about great athletes and overcoming adversity. Our next guest on this program had to leave a war-torn country to become a tennis great. Tom Tebbit in conversation with him in just moments. You're listening to Aces. I'm Roger Lajoie, and this is Sportsnet 590, The Fan. It's the terror of knowing. Roger Lajoie, Tom Tebbit. Aces is back for another season. Great to have you with us. We got a lot of emails to check. Roger at sportsnet590.ca. Tweet at the Rog 590. Questions for Tom Tebbit. You could win Rogers Cup tickets in our final segment. But right now, Tom Tebbit has an interview with a pretty special guy. Tom, tell us about it.
Ivan Ljubicic, a great guy, ranked number 3 in the world, led Croatia to the Davis Cup in 2005. He won 10 ATP titles. He was president of the Players' Council. And I should say, in one of his answers, the player he refers to is Feliciano Lopez. Even I had trouble understanding it. So I started by asking Ivan, who was in Croatia, does he ever wake up now? He retired 2 weeks ago in Monte Carlo. Does he ever wake up now and want to go out and play tennis?
No, not yet. I'm not sure if I'm going to have that feeling. But it's not coming back yet. No, I'm really enjoying my time with the family. It's all day real about kids. So not tennis yet in my mind.
So it's a good thing to have two young kids when you first retire. They take up all your time?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's no thinking about what happened or, you know, if I could, you know, go on or nothing. It's just really about kids. And my son is 3.5, so it's really a lot of fun with him. And daughter, obviously, 5 months old. So it's all about smiling and kissing and stuff. So it's really, I'm having a great time.
You were president of the ATP Players Council for a couple of years and also briefly on the ATP board. Roger's the president now. How distracting, how difficult is it to be the president, and how does it affect your tennis, what you do when you're on the tour?
Yeah.
Well, it's not too demanding. I mean, I was on a council for 6 years, and the one that I can remember that really affected my performance was 2006 U.S. Open, when I was ranked number 3. I was the 3rd seed, so I was really hot back then. And then we had a council meeting just night before my first round match, and I really got frustrated because things didn't go the way I thought they were supposed to go. And I went on the whole evening. We were discussing with friends what happened at a council meeting. And the day after, I lost like 4-4 and 4 against Feliciano Lopez. I was flat. So that was really the only time that I felt like the council really affected me in a negative way. And then since then, I really tried hard to make sure that the meetings are like Friday before the Grand Slam, like a couple of days, to give guys a couple of days before the tournament actually starts. So I think since then, the meetings were actually quite some time away from actual competition. So I'm 100% sure that it's not affecting the players at all.
Is the hardest part about being the president trying to reconcile the interests of the superstar players with the lower-ranked players?
Well, yeah. I mean, also seeing the big picture of the sports in general. You know, at meetings, you have to discuss, you have to see also the economics, the numbers, why this, why that. And, of course, we have higher-ranked players, lower-ranked players. We have Americans, we have European players, we have, It's a lot of different group of players that you need to take care of. And the one thing that, as a president or as a board representative itself, you have to really kind of try to step back and see what's the best for the sports in general, what's the best for the majority of the players. And sometimes you have to go against people that you like or you don't like. But, you know, in the end of the day, it's the responsibility of the president to really try to make sure that the sport is going in the right way.
What were the main issues you had to deal with as president?
Well, we had this brave new world, the tool that we see to today, we had a huge discussions back in 2007, 2008 about the Masters 1000, the 500, the 250s, the tools that we have today. And I remember the one that I really pushed hard as I could. I really never believed in the 500 category tournament. And I thought that players didn't need more commitment other than the Masters 1000. And that didn't go my way. The president back then, Etienne Davidier, together with the board on the tournament side, voted that there is a need for the 500 category to be in, and the players have to commit to play four out of those 11. And I felt that that wasn't right for the players, and I still feel that's the fact. And we see the players more and more injured, more and more stressed, and more tired, and it's really difficult to comply with all these commitments that the players have today.
What about the schedule? It's always a topic. Everybody says it's obviously too long, although Federer likes it being long and takes breaks during the year. What did you try to do about the schedule, and what would you actually ideally, how would you see the ideal schedule?
I think it's very, very romantic when we think about, you know, 9 month seasons. You know, I'm a little bit with Roger on this one. I think the problem in tennis is not generally the length of the season, but rather the commitment tournaments, what I just said, that where the players are forced to play. And I would like to see maybe less of those tournaments, or at least maybe compress them in 8 to 9 months, and then the rest, then the players can choose themselves if they want to play or not. And I think the players they need to take more responsibility. They have to be more responsible when they're picking the tournaments which they play. I mean, this winter I've seen the players playing 6-7 exhibitions in the off season, you know, and those players are injured at the moment. So I think the players need to be a little bit more objective as well, saying, you know, seeing the picture where they have to be very, very careful when to play and when maybe to take the rest. I mean, it's really tempting to play every week because obviously we make points, we make money when we play and not when we are back home practicing. But it's one of the most difficult maybe things today in tennis is to really pick the right tournament and do the right scheduling. And I would almost prefer to have tournaments the entire year and then, you know, just give the player the freedom to pick which one they want to play instead of, you know, cutting the season back to whatever, 10 months or 9 months, and then you're forced to take 3 months off. And sometimes that's not a great thing. I mean, I'm talking about, I mean, from my own perspective and my own experience. And whenever I had like a month and a half, 2 months off, I had a really difficult time to come back from there. I mean, all kind of injuries that came back, the old injuries, and bodies just kind of rest up and, you know, not ready for the action. So, but, you know, it's all very personal. I mean, we know that Rafa Nadal and Novak Djokovic are for the shorter season. Roger is for the longer. I mean, we will never have, you know, on these issues, we will never have a guy on the same side. So we just need to make sure that maybe, you know, the majority understands why the situation is like this and what's the benefit and how to deal with it.
A hot issue these days, and it may be still ongoing, is the share of money the players get at the Grand Slams. The Grand Slams make huge profits. At Wimbledon, I think they make $50 million, and I think out of that, $15 million is prize money that's already taken out. I mean, they could almost double the $15 million they give, and they'd still make $35 million profit. What do you see of the situation and the players wanting to get more money from the Grand Slam events?
Very difficult to talk about it, but I think the most important thing is to understand that the players not necessarily need more prize money. I mean, they just feel like they need a fair share, and this is where the problem starts. I mean, we're talking about the amount of money that goes into the prize money at the Slams. We're talking about something between 8% and 12% out of, you know, the whole revenue, which we just feel it's not fair. We understand that the prize money can't go. They cannot double or triple the prize money. That's fine. I mean, we understand that, but we just feel like the fair share should be different. And we understand that the Slams or the federations are investing into their youth players, young players, and they're investing back in tennis, back in sports, which is fine. But we just feel like, you know, the talent should be paid first before you make the numbers, and that's where we try to, I mean, now that the movement is set up, I mean, it looks like the guys are talking to the Grand Slams and trying to explain them why do we feel that the fair share is not right. And the share that we're getting is not right. It's not fair. And it looks like what Roland Garros and Wimbledon just did, we increased the prize money, especially in the first round, looks like they're getting the message. So we see now, I mean, it's a long project, it's a long process, and we will see where these things will be from, you know, 3, 5, or 10 years from now. But, you know, I think the Grand Slams are, there's no question about it, the biggest tournaments in our sport. And I think also then they don't want to see Masters 1000 really getting too close to them in a prize money level. So I'm sure that they will understand what players feel like, and then they will go in that direction.
Just going in a bit of a different direction, just is a bit of a strange thing, but as a player, the number of time a player bounces the ball before he serves, it's sometimes there's some controversy about that. Obviously, we know that Djokovic and Nadal are well known for doing that. Do you think there's anything that could be done to sort of control that? Because sometimes it's difficult, or a lot of times it's difficult for the returner, wondering when's he going to serve. Is he going to bounce it 8 times? Is he going to bounce it 18 times? Would you think there's anything that could be done about that?
Well, I mean, we've talked about the shot clock. You know, the problem of the shot clock that we had is that, you know, if you put the shot clock in the corner, the guy who is finishing the point at the net, has to run back in order to start the point. So, you know, so it's really, really difficult to say where is the line, where is when the point has to start, where is it has to go to the umpire to make the call. I mean, we do have a certain rules at the moment that are just not implemented. I mean, we have 25 seconds between points, the rules 20 seconds at the Grand Slam, but they are just not implemented by the umpires. I think the more is that we have a lot of rules out there that are there for the reason, but the umpires are just feeling like, you know, it would be too harsh to implement it against the players. And you know, as long as that's the case, no matter what kind of rule you make or you put out there, as long as the umpires are not implementing them, it's very difficult to change anything. But in that direction, you know, when I'm returning a serve from Nadal or Djokovic, you know, and it's a break point, it's a big point, I know they're gonna take a lot. It's gonna be a long break between points, so I'm trying to organize myself as well. So it doesn't really bother me personally, but I'm sure that the viewers on the TV or on the stands, they're more nervous about it, maybe even more than the opponent.
In 1999, you broke into the top 100, and I think over your career, you'd say that, you know, Djokovic, Nadal, Federer, and then Agassi and Sampras a little bit were sort of the great players. I noticed that you never had a chance to play against Sampras. Did you ever come close? Were you one match away, or do you regret not having had a chance to play him?
Well, I practiced with him many, many times, and that's something that, you know, fulfilled my dream, because he was one of my idols when I was growing up. So I don't remember being close to play against him, but I did really practice quite a lot. I mean, I remember one great practice that we had at US Open the year that he won the last time he played. We practiced on clay quite a lot because he also liked the fact that I was giving a lot of balls back that he could practice his shot. So we did practice quite a lot.
Well, the three greatest players today, obviously Djokovic, Nadal, and Federer. Can I ask you how you would play against each one of them, what your tactics were against them? So how would you have played against Novak?
Probably the most difficult one to say ultra, you know, this is the tactic, because I don't think there is one tactic to beat Novak Djokovic. You just have to do something that you do. You have to do extremely well. I think it's more easier maybe to beat Nadal, especially if you play on hard courts or faster courts. He's staying very, very far back. You can. I mean, I used when I played against him, I used like my wide serves on both sides, so to, you know, really to kick him out of the court, and then you can be aggressive. He doesn't really, if you play aggressive, he doesn't really take control of the point, so it's really up to you if you play. I always felt like if I play well against Rafa, I would have a chance to win a match. He's also not serving as good as Roger, rather, so you will always have chances also on the return games, and I never had a problem with returning with my backhand, so he serves onto my backhand, never really created me a problem. So against Roger, it's also another, I mean, it was difficult for me to play because we have pretty similar style of play. He was just doing everything a little better or a lot better, rather. So, you know, whatever I would come up with, different tactic, different approach to the match, he would just reply with the same thing, doing just a little better. And just really, I felt like every time when I get close, he would just do things better than me. And that was probably the most frustrating matches to play against Roger, because I just felt like he knows exactly what I'm going to do, and he's just going to be better. Against Novak, you know, he's one of the best returners in game, maybe the best. So when I beat him in Indian Wells, I was really serving unbelievable. So that was the key for me to attack his second serve. I know he's going for some of his second serve, so you have to be careful not to lean too much to the backhand. He loves to serve to the forehand on the big points in the second serve. And he's, I mean, if you have to pick the side to go forehand or backhand, I mean, forehand, it's a little weaker shot. So hopefully, you know, if it's a little windy or if there's a little tension, you will probably get a shorter ball up this, from the forehand wing rather than the backhand.
Yvonne, I was around your whole career. I think you are one of the most respected and admired players, and thank you very much for being a great ambassador for the sport.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
Great interview. What an emotional story, and what a great career he had, really.
Yeah, I mean, he left Bosnia at 13 years old, went to Italy. One thing I didn't get into him with, but he had the same coach for his whole career, which is not that common anymore. You have a couple of bad weeks, boom, the guy's gone. So
not with him.
A lot of commendable qualities about Yvonne.
Fantastic story indeed. That's Tom Tebbit. I'm Roger Lajoie. This segment of Aces is brought to you by Corona Extra, the official beer sponsor of the ATP Tour. Corona Extra, ready to serve, ATP World Tour's premier partner. Coming up, your chance to win Rogers Cup tickets. Tom has got them, and we'll show you how to win them in moments. You're listening to Aces. Roger Lajoie, Tom Tebbit on Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
Like free sports tickets, trips, and memorabilia so you can trick your friends, colleagues, and mistresses into thinking that you're some sort of high roller? Hey, join the club.
Welcome to the club.
The Fan Club. Log on to Sportsnet590.ca.
We were trying different things, and we were smoking funny things, making love out by the lake to our favorite song.
You're listening to Aces on Sportsnet 590 The Fan. I'm Roger Lajoie. Tom Tebbit is with me as always. This segment of Aces is brought to you by the National Bank, proud sponsor of the 2012 Rogers Cup. And speaking of the Rogers Cup, Tom's got some tickets. Just before we leave you tonight, we're going to have a new feature, new little game for you to play, and you will win a pair of Rogers Cup tickets. And what else, Tom, can they win over the course of the year?
Well, Roger, are we going to call this segment the Mystery Voice? Is that okay with you?
The Mystery Voice. Well, no, you've just said it's a Mystery Voice. Is it okay with me? It's too late. The Mystery Voice is coming up later. Tell us about the Mystery Voice, Tom Tebbit.
Well, no, it's coming up later, but I'll also tell you we are not going to have two cans of Wilson balls every week. What we're going to do this year is we're going to have one Wilson BLX Series racket, which we will put all the winners of the first 11 shows, and we'll select one, and they will get a Wilson BLX Series racket, which includes the Roger Federer racket.
Awesome. It's a great prize. So that's a reason to listen in to all 12 editions of Aces. You could win that racket if you can first identify the sound. We'll have it just before we leave you. But now it's time for Tom's mailbag. Can I call this Tom's mailbag? Is that okay with you? It's too late. Tom's mailbag is coming up next. We've asked for questions. You guys are, the audience here has just been so great. Tom and I haven't been on since like when we did the last show, September, October of last year, and we've got all kinds of questions. So let's try to get to as many as we can. Doug emails in. Doug, thank you. He had a question about the Tennis Channel on Rogers. Doug, it's a real political thing, as you can imagine, so we're going to stay away from that. I'll answer you by email later specifically why. Then he's got a question for Tom. Wozniak keeps playing very well, ranked 57th. But it's a struggle to break the top 50. Once her ranking was below 30, what's happened to the great Canadian hope? Also, has wants to ask about her, Marino and Stephanie Dubois. What is the future of these Canadian tennis players? And Doug, thank you for listening.
Well, I don't like to be talking about Alexandra Wozniak today because she lost to Tatishvili, and I watched a fair bit of the match today, and I thought she played fairly poorly. Tatishvili's 22 years old. She's sort of an expired phenom. About 4 or 5 years ago, she was expected to be a great player, and they were talking on the broadcast today about being her best win. So Alexandra really didn't play well, but she has played well lately. She's had some good results. She had a match point on Venus Williams, I think, in the third round in Miami last month, which was very impressive. And she's playing good tennis, but as I say, disappointing today. But Alexandra was as high as 21. She won the tournament in Stanford a few years ago. She had a terrible problem with her forearm for about a year, and it's only been, I'd say, maybe a year or so, less than a year almost, that she's back playing the way she can. So she's number 57 now. I think she can get higher than that for sure. I think she can get into the top 50, maybe the top 40. She's a fine striker of the ball, a good athlete, and you know, lots of potential that way. But you know, she's not going to shoot up the charts to number 10 or anything like that. Rebecca Marino's been off the tour now for a couple of months, seems to be taking sort of a mental and physical break. I don't think she's going to come back, certainly during the clay court season, maybe not even for the grass court
season. Just burnout with her, you think?
A little bit. We don't know. But you can have a 6 months. If you're out, you get an injury-protected ranking. So I think there's a chance she might not come back for 6 months, because then she's ranked 140 right now. She came back with an injury-protected ranking, say, in August or something. She'd be about 75, and at 75, she'd be able to get right into the U.S. Open, right into the Australian Open, probably play a bunch of tournaments, get into them that she'd be able to get into with an injury-protected ranking that she wouldn't if she just came back before that. And Stephanie Dubois is a good player, 25 years old. She's ranked 106 right now. She'll be directly into the French Open. So, you know, she's maybe on the wrong side of her career, but a very tenacious player, really hard worker. And, you know, she can cause you some problems if you're not at your best on that day.
Okay, interesting. Thanks again, Doug. Charlotte says, the Tennis Channel had the top 100 players, was interested. She had an issue with Andy Roddick being at 94 and Leighton Hewitt being at 63. Obviously, you think that's skewed a little bit. What about those two? Compare those two players for us, Tom. What do you think?
Well, I mean, I can see a little bit. Hewitt has won Wimbledon and the U.S. Open. Roddick's only won the U.S. Open, although he's in the Wimbledon final three times. So I think maybe I'd agree there's a bit of that's a gap, more than the 30 points between them. And, you know, Hewitt was involved, I think, some Davis Cup wins. Roddick was as well. So I think that's too much. 94 Roddick, 63 Hewitt. But that whole that Tennis Channel thing, I think the five greatest players of all time, and you know, it's easy to say, but I've always said Laver, Federer, Sampras, Pancho Gonzalez, and Bill Tilden. Now, Pancho Gonzalez was a fabulous player. He played most of it on the professional side when the professionals weren't allowed at Wimbledon stuff. But Gonzalez was ranked in the 30s on this thing, which is a joke. I mean, I'm an old-timer, so I know. So I think the Tennis Channel thing, it stirred up some interest, but I wouldn't put too much credibility in all of it.
The old school guy doesn't like those rankings at all. Thanks for the email. Vinny says, enjoying the program tonight. Thank you, Vinny. Wants to know about Sharapova, basically. We got so many emails, I want to get to as many as I can. So I'm going to cut them a little shorter. Could Sharapova one day win the French Open?
Well, she made the semifinals last year. I think she's played a lot better in clay the last few years, and obviously she won the tournament beating some very good players, beat Stosur, beat Kvitova, and then beat Azarenka in the final last weekend. So she's playing a lot better. Definitely she could. I'd still give her a bit more of a chance at Wimbledon or the U.S. Open.
Naraj has an interesting kind of fantasy match here. Federer playing Sampras, Wimbledon center court with both players in their time and the grass of the 1990s. Who wins? He can't uncategorically answer because we don't know, but it's an interesting question. Who do you like better?
Well, it's interesting. They did play each other. The only time they ever played was at Wimbledon, and Federer beat him 9-7 in the fifth set 2001. So it was still pretty close, and he served in volleys a lot. It was still pretty close to the grass then, so it's a real tough one. I might go with Sampras just because he's won 7 Wimbledons, Rogers won 6, and Sampras was just so good there and so tough. He was vulnerable in 2001 a bit, but just slightly, maybe Sampras.
Yeah, slightly is a word, though. Great players, both of them, no doubt about it. Sonic says, since the Hawkeye replay system came online a few years ago, chair umpires seem to be more reluctant to overrule line calls, particularly on the far sideline. I know some players have complained about this. The Hawkeye system was supposed to end these kind of disputes or kind of talk. Is it doing what it's supposed to do?
I think on the whole it is. The players like it a lot better because it sort of clears your mind, because you don't have to sort of play, geez, my ball was in. They show it up on the big screen. It was out. Boom, it solves it. So I think on the whole it's working well. Some of the umpires don't get involved as much because they just leave it up to the video. So, but I think people like it. People sitting in the stands, people sitting home watching on TV. It makes it all a little bit clearer. But I know Federer doesn't like it. Federer likes, he's so composed and so mature that he doesn't let these things bother him. So when he was playing, he preferred it when the other guys are thinking, oh, gee, my shot was good.
Right.
But
he
anyway.
Could let it roll off him. That's a great point about his mentality, isn't it? Kind of guy he was, for sure. Eric doesn't have a question, just a comment. How about a round of applause for Jennifer Capriati getting into the Hall of Fame? She's had some ups and downs in her career, but it was a great comeback story in tennis, if not sports history. Eric, pretty hard to argue with that, I would think.
Yeah, she won 4 Grand Slams. I think she won the Olympics in Madrid or Barcelona in 92. And no, terrific player, wonderful striker of the ball, terrific athlete, but pretty troubled kind of woman a lot of her career, which was too bad, but really a fine player.
Fine player indeed. We had so many. We're not going to be able to get to them all, folks, but we'll save them up and we'll ask Tom. This features part of the show, Tom's mailbag. We've got Danielle with the tweet. Danielle, thanks for tweeting. She says, American tennis era is really almost over. Roddick and Fish withdrawing. Who does Tom expect to be the best from the new wave of USA talent? Now, that's a good question, because the United States is looking for the next tennis hero. Who's that going to be?
Well, John Isner's playing very well. I think he's number 10 in the world now, and he's a terrific player. And Ryan Harrison is the young guy, but I don't think Harrison is as good as Milos Raonic. So we'll have to see about Harrison. But it's not the best it could be for the Americans to sort of in terms of the future. But right now, with Isner playing well and Harrison on the horizon, maybe a little better than it was a couple of years ago.
Is Brian emails about Isner, actually, and asks, could he win the French Open this year because he's improved his ground game? Brian's a real tennis fan for sure. He's had some wins over Djokovic on hard court, Federer and Song on clay. Can he break through at some point in time soon?
A lot of people sort of wonder because he beat Federer early this year on clay, and he beat Djokovic at Indian Wells, and he's played well on clay. But I think a big guy like that is 6'9". You can beat anybody on the day, but you got to win seven matches to win a Grand Slam, and I think it's very hard to see him going through the kind of players he'd have to go through seven different matches.
One more tweet, then we got to get to our contest. Philip says, will women's tennis ever reach the same height and mainstream attention as men's tennis is right now? Sometimes it goes in cycles, but the men usually rule the roost in tennis, don't they?
I would say, yeah. I mean, there was a time around the Safin-Hewitt when they came on the scene in like 2000, 2001, 2002, where the women with, the Williams sisters, Hennen, Clijsters, Sharapova wasn't quite there yet, but the men are just so strong now. It's hard to see anybody. But I think there's some good signs with the women these days. Sharapova's coming on. Serena's coming back. I saw this girl, Mona Barthel, play last week in Stuttgart, German, very good player. So things are looking up.
Okay, time for our mystery sound item and contest. This segment is brought to you by TheMerchantOfTennis.com, celebrating 20 years, MerchantOfTennis.com, game, set, shop. Tom, take it away and introduce tonight's mystery voice for us.
Well, we're going to guarantee that Roger's got the sound wave music going here to sort of have a little mystery about what happens here. But we're going to make this one a fairly easy one, but we're going to make it tougher as the weeks go on. So, bingo, here is this week's mystery voice.
Absolutely. It was very emotional again, to be part of something so unique, because it doesn't come around that often, I don't think I'll have 15 children, So, I was very emotional, and Mirka as well. It's a very intense moment, All of a sudden, it hits you, and it's right in front of you, and it's about to happen, and it's something so different that it got me going emotionally. Even though for 9 months, I was completely cool, laid back.
Holy smokes! I hope it gets tougher than that.
Not Wendell Clark,
apparently,
Roger.
Apparently not. All right, now, if you know it, here's what you got to do. Roger at sportsnet590.ca. Email Roger at sportsnet590.ca or tweet me at TheRog590, TheRog590. And our next show is May 24th. And we've got another one May 31st around the French Open. Tom will announce the winner then, and we'll send it out to you before then. Again, the mystery voice, you just heard it. Tell us who it is. We'll make a draw among the winners and then win those great Rogers Cup tickets.
Yeah, they're for Monday night, the first Monday of the tournament, and the men are in Toronto this year. They always try to do something a little bit special on the Monday night, so I'm sure people enjoy going. And if you don't get this one, I don't think you have a right to participate the rest of the year.
Wrong answers will be eliminated for life. I'm Roger Lajoie for Tom Tebbit. Tom, it was a lot of fun. We'll talk to you in 2 weeks, my friend.
Okay, Roger.
That's Tom Tebbit. I'm Roger Lajoie. Thanks to Derek Brandeo, Igor Enriquez. Aces returns May 24th. Drop us an email or a tweet, folks. And we will see you on May the 24th. You're listening to Sportsnet 590, The Fan.